You're listening to The Naked Pravda. This is Medusa's first and only English language podcast, so please don't be shy about recommending us to your friends and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in. Welcome to The Naked Pravda, a podcast that highlights how Medusa's top reporting intersects with the wider research and expertise that exists about Russia. If you listen to this show regularly, and I hope to gosh you do, that introduction is probably getting a little old. The same goes for this next part. It's the introduction to me. I am your host, Kevin Rothrock, the managing editor of Medusa's English Language Edition. I say this every episode for our millions and billions of new listeners, because I want you to feel welcome and informed and certainly, you know, not late to the party. So stay a while, why don't you? On today's show, we'll be discussing euphemisms in Russian journalism when it comes to reporting on disasters, specifically gas explosions, which was the subject of an investigative report by Medusa's Alexei Kovalev in mid-February. Here we are, approaching mid-April, almost 2 months later, and the story is still relevant and still newsy, and not just because stuff is still blowing up all the time in Russia, but because the coronavirus pandemic represents a disaster on a whole other scale. So what am I talking about when I say euphemisms in reporting? Medusa's story from February focused on a trend in the Russian media that began late last year, when state news outlets increasingly started describing gas explosions as gas pops in their coverage, even when talking about incidents that caused major damage to life and property. We're talking about destroyed buildings and dead bodies here. In fact, the number of gas pops mentioned in news reports jumped from a few dozen stories in early 2017 to thousands of such reports by January 2020. Medusa's sources in the Putin administration and in Russia's security agencies, moreover, say this is the result of a targeted policy to introduce more favorable information conditions meant to avoid a public panic when reporting on things like gas explosions. One of the most familiar news euphemisms, in war reporting at least, is probably the term collateral damage. And it's not just a very bad Arnold Schwarzenegger movie from 2002. It's also one of those Orwellian phrases that was especially popular in the 1990s, in the Gulf War, in the Kosovo War, when the U.S. military used it to describe killing civilians in attacks on supposedly legitimate targets.
Well, collateral damage is people who died because you dropped bombs on them or, you know, or killed in other ways in the course of the war. But collateral damage just sounds so much nicer. So there's all kinds of ways that language privileges certain groups and takes privilege away from other groups.
That's Sarah Oates, an expert in political communication and democratization who teaches as a professor at the University of Maryland in the Philip Merrill College of Journalism. She's been on this podcast before. So you see, folks, this show is so wonderful that guests are even willing to return. It's a vote of confidence, I tell you. Anyway, I asked Dr. Oates how scholars approach the study of euphemisms like collateral damage and gas pops.
So the notion of codes and coding and encoding and decoding in news and other texts, it's an entire discipline in academia all by itself. So this whole notion of the way that language reflects power and those in power get to set the terms of language and set the terms of debate, it's an enormous way that people have of understanding why things are reported in the way they are. So you can kind of look at this from really a bird's eye, top-down view of saying that power in general dictates the sort of language that's used, whether we're talking about whether someone is pro-life or anti-abortion. And that's just one example of the way that language makes distinctions and gives power to different groups about how to define things.
Alexei Kovalev, the journalist who wrote Medusa's story about gas pops, says he started noticing the terminology in news headlines when he began seeing the dark humor it inspired on social media.
A lot of people started noticing this and on social media and highlighting these quite ridiculous instances where there's a photograph on the RIA Novosti website or another state-owned agency where there's just a smoking rubble. And this, apparently, according to the headline, is a result of a pop, chlapok. And of course, people were ridiculing it and mimifying it. So there were these memes with nuclear mushroom clouds and chlapok added to them. It definitely gave gave birth to a new strain of really dark humor.
One thing Alexei discovered when writing his story is that there actually is such a thing as a gas pop. That's distinct from a gas explosion. They're both technical terms you can find in emergency manuals at various power companies and so on. A burst, or a pop, is the rapid combustion of a combustible mixture not accompanied, by the formation of compressed gases capable of destroying structures or installations. An explosion, meanwhile, is a rapid exothermic chemical transformation of an explosive environment accompanied by the release of energy and the formation of compressed gases capable of destroying structures or installations.
A pop is an explosion that doesn't cause any structural damage. So it's loud and it sets something alight, but it doesn't really destroy stuff. Whereas an explosion is something that is... powerful enough to cause significant physical damage. So yeah, it's a technical term.
Alexei says terminology finds its way from press releases issued by government agencies into reports issued by state news agencies.
Our emergency response ministry uses these terms in their press releases, and when they put out these press releases about these gas pops, editors at state media they kind of really just copy and paste these press releases and slap a headline on them and turn them into news stories without adding much context or detail. So they're just kind of doing this automatically, because some people in presidential administration told the emergency ministry's press service to use the word pop to keep the nasty stuff, the explosions, away from the headlines.
This isn't the only euphemism that slips from press releases into news reports. Like other examples of government newspeak, such as saying saturation or подтопление instead of flooding, наводнение, and flaring up, возгорение, instead of fire, пожар, the term gas pop is part of the Russian presidential administration's information policy, sources told Medusa.
It's a deliberate policy of masking masking these bad news with the aim of creating something that our sources call режим информационного благоприятствования, which in English sounds kind of more bland. I guess that would be favorable information conditions or something. But yeah, it's basically to keep the bad news away by neutering the language of these news. Because the people on top of Russia's hierarchy, they don't venture out too much in the world. So all they can see is the daily press clippings that the aides compile for them. And it doesn't look good when these press clippings are full of explosions and death.
Alexei says there are euphemisms at play in the reporting about coronavirus as well, though officials have been more transparent than your typical anti-Kremlin oppositionist would probably admit.
The same logic is applied to the coronavirus crisis. So there's a lot of I'm seeing a lot of speculation online, especially in non-Russian sources, that Russia's death toll from coronavirus is kind of unbelievably low compared to other countries like Italy or the United States. So something is amiss, people are saying. They must be hiding bodies there, which I don't find plausible myself, because I, of all people, as an investigative journalist, I would have found out if there were mortuaries stacked with bodies somewhere or mass graves popping up on the edge of town. People would have noticed. People would have noticed and posted it on social media. We would have verified it and made a huge story out of it. So nobody in Russia really finds that story believable, that the Russian government is hiding the real death toll. But what people in Russia are wondering about is the stats where you have, when you have this curve of people, this example hospital in Moscow, which treats the most of the COVID-19 patients in Russia. Yeah, it's Surgeon General puts out daily statistics about you know, people admitted to the hospital and discharged. So there's one term that keeps popping up. So you have people with coronavirus. That's clear. But then you have a much larger number of people with something that they called внебольничная pneumония. I looked it up, and they as far as I understand, it's a technical term as well, and it translates as community acquired pneumonia. So it's something that you have. It's vague, but it's also, you know, manipulative enough. It sounds manipulative enough. Like you're taken by to a hospital, and your diagnosis is community acquired pneumonia. And people are wondering, you know, how many of these community acquired pneumonia cases are actually COVID, because COVID, what the coronavirus does, it destroys your lungs in the worst cases, and you have pneumonia. And when you die of coronavirus-related complications, in many cases, it's pneumonia. And people are wondering if they are actually ascribing some of these COVID deaths to this vague technical term, community-acquired pneumonia.
How much of this is like directly bad intentions, and how much of it is just sort of the way that reporting happens? Like you mentioned before, that a lot of news agencies essentially just sort of regurgitate the official press reports issued by state agencies. But at the same, so in the story itself that you wrote about the gas pops and the gas explosions, I got the sense that you were almost hedging your bets, because you're floating multiple theories. You're saying, well, they do report, you know, just the sort of newspeak that filters down from the press releases. But then there are also sort of, you know, rumors and anonymous sources saying that the Kremlin has direct briefings with the heads of press services, where, you know, Putin's first deputy chief of staff, Alexei Gromov, is actually issuing direct instructions. But then we're also, learning that some reporters are just saying that they're just playing it safe and relying on conservative language until they know more in a disaster situation. And then when it comes to coronavirus, you know, maybe they're recording deaths, or they're recording cases as pneumonia or something else, because they want to keep the official numbers down for COVID. Or maybe it's just that the COVID tests are not very accurate and there's too many false negatives, and so now they're going to treat them together, but they can't necessarily diagnose them with COVID if they don't have a positive test result. But, you know, they're aware that it could be a coronavirus patient even if they can't get a positive test result. Like, how much of this is sort of malicious, and how much of it is the consequence of either procedures or a lack of resources or something like that?
You asked me to measure it. I would say 80% of it is just complacence. You know, this is just the way things work in Russia. So I was really hoping that it was more straightforward in the Russian original, but the gas pops, they trickle down. So they formulate policy at the top level, and it trickles down to individual editors who are just doing it automatically. An editor tells them, their superior tells them once, that you should use the language exactly as it appears in the press release. So they say, okay, boss, and they just go on with it and never think about it again. Because all they want to do is just get through the day and keep their job. So it's above their pay grade to ask why it should be a pop when it's obviously an explosion. It's the same with doctors who probably have instructions that they follow. They may be absurd. They have instructions and protocols, and they may seem absurd to us, but they have this sort of internal logic that they follow.
Alexei says many in the state media were slow to realize the seriousness of the coronavirus pandemic, but journalists of all stripes now have dropped the euphemisms for the most part and have started talking straight with the public.
I mean, those talking heads on TV back in January, they were very dismissive about the whole coronavirus thing, and pretty much like Fox News, calling it just a regular seasonal flu that's gonna pass and kill fewer people than car crashes do or regular flu does. But then you could see that in early March they really started taking the whole thing seriously, Actually, they are doing a fairly good job covering the crisis on Russian state media. They're not really downplaying it. No, they are in full crisis mode, and they are telling people to stay home because it's dangerous. It's very contagious. Because look at this, look at ICUs filling up. No, they're actually saying that. So I don't see any reason for Russian authorities to be involved in some kind of major cover-up operation to play down the numbers of COVID victims. No, they're actually making it very clear that this is dangerous, this is a public health crisis, and you should really strictly follow the rules. And yeah, I can see that it's working. Like I'm seeing from my window that my usually busy street is virtually empty now. So people are staying inside because the authorities told them so.
I asked Sarah Oates how this relationship between the authorities and the press typically plays out across various political regimes. In authoritarian states, you might expect governments simply to tell journalists what to say, which is some of what we've observed with the Russian media and Alexander Gromov in the Kremlin, for instance. In liberal democracies, that's not supposed to be possible. But even here, the authorities have plenty of power to, you know, manipulate the press. When we think of coordinated messages and euphemistic narratives, should we be imagining secret phone calls in the middle of the night? Notes, you know, scribbled with instructions about what to say, passed under the table? How does this sort of thing actually work, generally speaking?
When we think about who gets to say what and when and where and how, there's often the sort of assumption, you know, sort of this deep state assumption that the state is telling journalists what to say. And I have to say that that's pretty rare, even in authoritarian regimes. It's more kind of a shared understanding of one hand washing the other. And that's how you wind up with that. There's been other situations in which if, for example, the White House comes up with a really compelling frame, such as war on terror, which the Bush White House did come up with post 9/11, then that gets picked up by lots and lots of media organizations. And it becomes enormously difficult to say, wait a minute, the actual terrorists that we're concerned about aren't in the country we're invading, which was true. But it wasn't so much that a whole bunch of memos were sent to American journalists compelling them to do this, as it was this really resonant narrative that people wanted to get on board with.
When Johnny comes marching home again, hurrah, hurrah, we'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah, hurrah, the men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel gay when Johnny comes marching home, and we'll all feel gay when Johnny comes marching home.
You know, back before I was a media scholar and I was a journalist, I would have laughed at the idea that anyone could tell me what to do, right? I would have been very skeptical about that. Now that I've studied certain media campaigns, particularly the War on Terror campaign, you know, that came right out of the White House. And it was an extremely compelling and powerful frame that drove a lot of public opinion and, of course, re-entering the war in Iraq. So I'm much more let's say, accepting of the idea that really good strategic communication campaigns can influence the way that things are framed. That being said, there's plenty of times when frames or the ways of looking at things emerge much more organically from the situation. And we're in a really interesting situation right now with coronavirus, because what we really need now is a kind of resolute frame. And that's not being promulgated by anyone, particularly. So instead, you see a lot of chaotic framing and a lot of confusion.
Does this, like, this fight over language from the perspective of sort of like power privilege and euphemisms and codes and all that, is it most salient when it comes to talk of disasters? Or is this something like, can you have this level discussion about really kind of anything reported in the news of public concern?
You know, it's really interesting about how people approach decoding and coding and encoding in the news. I'm a big proponent of looking at it during disasters, because my feeling is when you have a big disaster, whether it's 9/11 or the coronavirus or whatever it is, you get a lot of, you get almost like big bang of media coverage, right? So you get a lot of almost chaotic coverage. So I think in that way, you can see a lot of the processes that are often kind of hidden underneath. As journalists struggle to find ways to patrol the boundaries of culture, as it were, because that's what journalists sort of do. When they're in situations in which the rules aren't clear and the frames aren't set, the language gets very diverse and very interesting. So there's a really good media scholar named Doris Graber, and she wrote about this idea of crisis coverage. And she pointed out that in crises, you have all this need for news, but you don't really have a lot of news. So what happens is you just sort of fill it in with anything you can find. So there's kind of a lot of garbage out there. So I think that when you see that kind of thing going on, it's sort of almost a much more natural play of language. It's untamed language. And I think in that you get a lot of interesting things being said and suggested that you wouldn't see in normal times. It's almost as though you can kind of peel back a kick over the rock, right? And see what's underneath.
You've been listening to The Naked Pravda, a podcast that highlights how Meduza's top reporting intersects with the wider research and expertise that exists about Russia. On today's show, we spoke to Professor Sarah Oates and Meduza investigative journalist Alexei Kovalyov about euphemisms in disaster reporting. On our next episode, we'll look at the effects of Russia's coronavirus quarantine on the country's justice system and prisons. The Naked Pravda is a podcast from Meduza, our first and only English language show. And I hope you'll recommend us to your friends and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you are tuning in to help put this program in front of more people. Thank you for listening, and come back soon.